welcome to Bee Radio. Hope you're all having a good day. I'm TJ.
And I'm Rhea.
And I'm Ben.
And we're all politics students here at the University of Reading. And we'll be taking over today's show to bring you a segment all about trade unions. A very topical and current discussion given all the strike action taking place that I'm sure you've been affected by in some way or another.
Just before we get into that, we want to give you a quick news bulletin surrounding local, national and international news stories.
In international news, Australia, the UK and US have signed a landmark nuclear submarine deal, and a Chinese embassy have caused what Boris Johnson calls raucous squawkers from the anti-AUKUS caucus. And are Putin's Danes counted as the International Criminal Court issues an arrest warrant against the Russian president?
And in recent national news, women are being manipulated amongst crisis pregnancy advice centres. And in other headline news, Brexit discussions on the Northern Ireland Protocol.
And in local news, Berkshire midwife reported to regulator over baby's death, and the Royals come from behind to claim point against Hull.
Now to discuss the stories further. AUKUS is an alliance between Australia, the UK and the US. AUKUS will initially focus on helping Australia procure a multi-billion pound fleet of nuclear-powered submarines. According to an AUKUS briefing document, the aim is for three nations to provide an assured undersea capability that contributes to stability, peace and prosperity in the Indo-Pacific and around the world. China has been vocal in its opposition to this deal from the beginning, unsurprising given the alliance is designed to counter Beijing's influence at sea. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman added at the time, "The US and UK's action of exporting highly sensitive nuclear submarine technology once again proves that they are using nuclear exports as a tool for geopolitical games and ADAPT's double standards." Do you guys agree that the UK signed this deal for more nuclear power, and are they acting with double standards?
Yeah, I think obviously, I think it's more about security. I think Britain's wanting to show power, and obviously Britain always wants an alliance to go up against global superpowers, and also to show, to scare off other nations by having a nuclear deterrent.
Yeah, and power is always, you know, something that plays a big role in countries procuring nuclear sources. With China having so much power over this other states for nuclear sources, it can create tensions.
Yeah, I can understand why China has concerns. And it's also a breach of the NPT, which states that you cannot transfer nuclear technology from a nuclear weapon state to a non-weapon state, which is what the US and UK are doing to Australia. But they claim to have found a loophole. Another topical international story is the issues of Putin's arrest warrant by the ICC, International Criminal Court. Forced deportation of populations is recognised as a crime under the Rome Statute that established the court. Russia was a signatory to the Rome Statute, but withdrew in 2016, saying that it did not recognise this jurisdiction of the shore. Because of this, it's unlikely Putin will surrender to the courts. However, the warrant remains significant as, for one, warrants are usually addressed privately, but ICC has done it publicly due to the situation. And secondly, it scares other senior officials who could be prosecuted to travel internationally to those countries who have signed to the court. What are your thoughts about the arrest warrant?
I mean, I just don't think anyone's going to catch him, personally. I just think Putin's got too much power, and I don't really understand who would really want to risk any conflict with Russia.
Yeah, I understand the warrant. Putin's actions of invasion and deportation of Ukrainians is blatantly a war crime, but I feel like shouldn't every world leader then be issued a warrant, as many of their actions would make them also count as war criminals? And Putin has recently visited Ukraine, and correspondents are taking this as a message being sent that he is unfazed by the warrant and can go wherever he wants.
Yes, and Putin has been getting away with many crimes against Ukrainians that, due to his power that he holds, people could be worried about placing limitations on him.
I think many people would be disturbed by these pictures released of Putin just strolling around Ukraine, which was a bomb site last year due to him. But you could argue there is not much Putin does that surprises anybody anymore. It's the type of thing Ukraine might expect from him.
And back to national news, women are being manipulated by care centres into having an abortion. These women who are seeking advice from these centres are based outside the NHS and work under the branch of the charity sector. These charities give aid for support and advice on unplanned pregnancies. It has been recently found that more than a third of such services give out misleading information or advice that is considered unethical. Across England, Wales and Northern Ireland, provide key services and assistance for women dealing with such circumstances are available. The BBC took to investigating their own terms to find women to tell their stories on their experiences of being manipulated by these charities. In my opinion, this is something that should not be happening for women. And with a topic like this, it's so difficult on many levels amongst an emotional drive to deal with this hurdle. So what do you guys think about this issue concerning women?
I agree. Abortion's a very sensitive topic, and if you're unsure on what to do, you're already in a vulnerable position. So pressure and manipulation is really bad for these charities to be taking advantage of this, especially if these women have gone to these places specifically seeking help.
Yeah, absolutely. I think these people should be held accountable, honestly, and I think should be prosecuted and charged for what they're doing.
Yeah.
The second area of discussion to bring into attention is that of Brexit, which is something that has been underlying since 2016. This protocol entails the determination in regards to trade rules with which would be with Northern Ireland now post-Brexit, as Ireland has a border, as we know, with the EU that it shares for trading goods freely between them. Those who support this agreement see it as a mitigation against the consequences of Brexit. Brexit has been in discussion since the vote took place in 2016, continuing to have constant issues over trade. The Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, has hinted that Mr. Sunak should not abandon the Northern Ireland Protocol Bill in his quest for a deal to break the deadlock, as hope faded that an agreement could be done soon. With unionists as well fearing that Rishi Sunak's new Brexit deal is driving a wedge between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK. What do you guys think about this deal? Do you think that Brexit issues should have been resolved a long time ago?
I do. I think this deal has been going on for a long time and an agreement is overdue. At the same time, I don't think it should be rushed to a deal that nobody's happy with. The land border was always going to be a long discussion given Ireland's political history, as it was feared introducing cameras and checks in a hard border would create instability. From businesses' points of view, their issue is that checks mean extra costs and delays. But with the introduction of the Windsor framework, Britain is hoping to reduce the number of checks to resolve everybody's worries.
Yeah, I don't know about you, but I think a lot of people are just tired of the Brexit discussion by now.
Really?
And just want it done.
Wasn't Brexit meant to be done back in 2016?
So yeah.
Honestly.
Back to the story I brought you earlier in local news. An agency midwife has been reported to the nursing regulator after a coroner raised concerns over a baby's death. Rania Khan died in May 2020, 19 days after she was born at the Royal Berkshire Hospital in Reading. Senior Berkshire coroner Heidi Connor said the labour was not properly monitored, although the failure may not have been caused to death. The hospital said it complied with the coroner's instructions to refer the case to the Nursing and Midwifery Council. In a Prevention of Future Deaths report, Mrs. Connor said the Band 6 midwife, who she did not name, failed to recognise signs of it from the fetal trace. She also did not conduct proper reviews, mistook the maternal heart rate for the babies, and did nothing about the mother's high pulse rate, Ms. Connors said. Khan died on 28th of May 2020 from the effects of severe artillery pulmonary hypertension. High blood pressure affecting the lungs of unknown cause, the coroner concluded. Mrs. Connors said she discovered during the inquest that the hospital had not reported the case. So I just wondered, do you think the midwife should be punished?
I believe that it's justified because the midwife ignored many aspects that could have been resolved. And as you said about the heart rate for both mother and baby, this is something of life and death. And it's a midwife's job to respond to anyone having these issues and bring a doctor with these issues if they can't.
Yeah, it's a difficult one as it's hard. The midwife's state that day of the death and if she actually caused the death, as you mentioned, but she most likely did contribute. She may not have been fully focused on the job and this has resulted in the worst fatality. Either way, it is manslaughter and I think the lack of reporting and missing checks that are necessary in the job, which you know there are consequences for if you miss these big sighs, justify a punishment.
Absolutely, yeah. I think it's a very difficult topic. In other news, Reading FC ended a run of four championship defeats on the bounce by recovering to take a point against Hull City. The Royals went behind to Regan Slater's 26th minute opener, but replied on the stroke of half-time for Andy Carroll. Neither side were able to snatch a winner and had to settle for a point each. Reading stay in the 16th position, 9 points above the relegation zone, prior to a possible points deduction from the EFL with 8 matches remaining. Following the international break, Reading away to Bristol City on September the 1st of April.
Go Reading!
Yeah, another story that I wanted to bring up that I saw in the news recently, Gary Lineker tweet scandal. I don't know if you guys were aware of it, but pretty much Gary Lineker was absent from presenting Match of the Day on Saturday night, along with pundits and commentators. The BBC suspended Lineker from his Match of the Day presenting duties following a tweet it deemed to be breach of its guidelines. In a statement, the BBC said it has decided that he will step back from presenting Match of the Day until we got an agreed and clear position on his use of social media. Lineker took to Twitter to hit out at the illegal migration bill, which bans migrants who arrive in small boats from settling in Britain. He tweeted, "This is just an immeasurable, cruel policy directed at the most vulnerable people in language that is not too similar to used by Germany in the 30s. And am I out of order?" he questioned. The stars of Match of the Day, Ian Wright and Alan Shearer, also stepped back from this solidarity to Lineker. He was then later reinstated, BBC. I just thought it was an interesting topic to you, because I thought, you know, just wanted to see what your views were on the topic.
Yeah, I did see it. I feel like, how could you have missed it? It was on the covers of most newspapers, even though there probably were more important things to probably report about.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
But, yeah, no, I had quite a few things to say about it. I feel like you can start off with your points and I'll follow it.
I think, do you think it's his responsibility to stay impartial as he represents the BBC?
Yeah, I feel like I personally don't think on his own personal social media account, he is a sports presenter, little editor, or somebody that brings nation like politics, and yeah. He didn't say it on the BBC. But obviously the BBC guidelines do state impartiality is a clause of employment. It's applied to Gary, he's not a permanent member of the team, he is a freelancer. So yeah. I do think that is a bit ridiculous to be talking about impartiality, considering that the BBC chairman, Richard Sharp, donated £800,000 to Boris Johnson, then was elected chair. I don't think he really should be suspended for being impartial towards the government, personally.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in my opinion, I just think it's a bit ridiculous, because I think it's true, he's a sports presenter. He's not a news reporter. And I think, you know, everyone has the right to say what they feel. There's freedom of speech. And it's, at the end of the day, it's his own private platform. I mean, how can you stop someone discussing how they feel about a topic? It is a bit ridiculous. I think the other issue that they raised was perhaps BBC presenters who have it in their contract that they have to stay impartial. Obviously, I think that was what they were discussing, the kind of the legal side to that. But I think overall, I'm happy that he was put back in. I think it was raised a lot of issues about freedom of speech and what's right and wrong.
Definitely. I agree with that. I agree with what both of you are saying.
And I think when talking about these issues, it's interesting to question, is it really political, when I think he is actually speaking more about human rights?
Yeah.
He's like, I get by saying, like, comparing the governments of 1930s Nazi Germany brings the politics into it, but you can have an opinion on what you think is a breach of human rights, and that's not to do with politics. So, and what I think is interesting is about what I mentioned earlier about it being the headlines. And Keir Starmer made an important point about the media coverage, saying how the legislation should probably be the key focus, but the papers are posting about scandal of him being removed from. It's like, that's what you should be reporting. I think his exact quote was, "Because at the heart of this is the government's failure on the asylum system, and rather than they take responsibility for the mess they've made, the government is casting around to blame anybody else. Gary Lineker, the BBC, civil servants, etc." So,
yeah, absolutely. And bringing back to what you said, I mean, the sad thing about it is that although he was raising a difficult point about the new bill, it was actually he that was the headlines of all the newspapers. And and don't you think the government probably, that might have been a strategic move, that they decided to kind of put the attention towards him rather than the actual issue at hand. And I think that happens quite a lot in this country.
Yeah, Rishi Sunak even came out to make a statement, I think covering his own back, as he want to be considered as the reason, like, the favourite presenter, Gary Lineker's been removed. He kind of was like, oh, the BBC and Gary have got to deal with this. Personally, it's not to do with us, when it is. That's why the conversation was started. But, yeah, I think talks are now in play about even reforming these contracts to say that a social media profile is separate to impartiality on air. So,
yeah, absolutely. Let's
see what happens.
Yeah, this question about freedom of speech is similar to the case of J.K. Rowling and her controversial comments on Twitter about trans women. The initial tweet said back in 2020, June the 6th, people who menstruate apparently taking issue with the fact that the story did not use the word women. People who menstruate, I'm sure there used to be a word for those people. Someone help me out. Wumben, wimpund, wumud, she wrote.
The initial tweet created a lot of backlash, but the Harry Potter author did not relent and wrote about her views in more detail. She does not believe she is being hateful and just states that she believes trans women have a different experience to cis women, and this has led to people cancelling her.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a real conversation to be had about freedom of speech and, you know, is it too far sometimes? So is there a point where freedom of speech should be limited, do you think?
I think when freedom of speech becomes hate speech, it's different. If it is an opinion and you're not being discriminatory, then on your own account, you can say as you like. And Twitter and other social media have regulations to try and limit hate speech. But then again, she does have a big platform, so it's hard to understand what she can say and can't say.
Yes, and freedom of speech is important to have, but should be given limitations, especially if there could be a negative impact after. Also, with the platform that she does have, it's important to be aware of both sides. With comments about only women being to menstruate and non-trans women not being able to, the community could find this upsetting, and she needs to be aware that the backlash she'll get is not going to be positive.
Yeah, and I feel like when talking about these subjects, at the end she was kind of like joking, mocking. So if she was going to approach it, just be a bit more sensitive. And this links to the question of, should art be separated from the artist? And because J.K. Rowling has different views, should she stop consuming the Harry Potter books and films?
I believe it should be separated because, you know, as we know, the Harry Potter legacy should still be upheld as it's become such a huge franchise. And, you know, it's unfair as well to tarnish what she's created, what she's built, and, you know, how much attention and how many fans are still, you know, running around loving Harry Potter and all of that.
Yeah, I agree. And it isn't a mistake, it is her views, however. So because she's not apologised, like, it's not something that she's just said on a whim. It is what, and she sticks by it. So, but I do agree, I do not think this is reflected in her work. So I don't think you should stop consuming Harry Potter because you disagree with what she's saying.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think in you know, modern society as well, you've got to be aware that, you know, everyone can see what your views are on social media. You have a big audience, and I think with the freedom of speech idea, you should be allowed to say what you want, but I think you also have to be held accountable if it goes too far, and there should be a limit. But on the other hand, I do still think that you should be able to appreciate her work as well.
I agree.
That is our news roundup for today. Thank you.
Now we bring you a short audio documentary we've created where we explore trade unions and strikes occurring and interview those affected, as well as discuss the history and significance of trade unions.
Let's begin with asking, what actually is a trade union?
Well, a trade union is a group of employees that unite together to maintain and improve the conditions of their employment.
Yes, a common misconception is that trade unions act in order to get more money, when this isn't the case. It's also about their rights. Unions have brought changes such as the abolition of child labour, safer working conditions, improved parental leave, secure pensions, and much more.
Trade unions are structured and have a union rep who will negotiate agreements with employees on what they want.
The areas we're going to focus on in this documentary is the action taking place in the public sector. The nurse and ambulance strikes, railway strikes and educators strikes.
Firstly, let's explain what each sector is striking about and what they're trying to achieve. Beginning with the health sector, for nurses, the RCN, Royal College of Nursing, wants a pay rise of 5% above inflation. Although they have already said they're willing to meet the government halfway, junior doctors in England want a pay rise to make up for what they describe as a 26% drop in earnings once inflation is taken into account. And ambulance services trusts are seeking a 17% pay rise.
I consider these reasonable requests, as it's recently been revealed that a prep barista makes more than a junior doctor, as prep increased their salary to £14.10 an hour, whereas new medics make £14.09 an hour. And this is the message they're sending to the government, that they could be making more serving coffee than saving lives.
Yes, and if you take into account the massive debt they incur over 6-7 years of medical school and the excruciating hours junior doctors undertake, they really ought to be paid more.
Exactly. In fact, we managed to ask a few questions to an ambulance worker who is at the forefront of what is going on within the NHS. Let's pass over to our correspondent on the ground, Rhea, to find out more.
Welcome Alex Caulfield, who is an ambulance worker under the NHS in Chippenham. She has been working under this branch for a number of years. Today, she's with us to discuss the impact and thoughts on strikes. So my first question to you is, are you part of a union for your ambulance workers and nurses? And do they approach you?
Well, thank you for having me. Thank you for the question. I'm not part of any of the unions. However, there are two available for the ambulance service in the UK. So you can either choose to be part of Unison or GMB. The reason I'm not part of a trade union is because they charge a weekly fee. It's not very much, but it can add up. And you are able to still use quite a lot of the services, like the advocate, things like that, when you're actually not even a member. So I'm basically just saving myself the membership cost, but you can still use them if you really need them.
Thank you. That's really interesting. And the second question to you, do you view yourself taking part in the strikes? And if you took part, what were your reasons?
So I personally have not taken part in the strikes. The main reason for this, to be completely honest, is because I haven't been scheduled to work on the strike dates. I believe that if I had been rotated in to work on those dates, I would probably have taken part. Now, you can also still go along to the picket line even if you're not scheduled to work, but it's quite a long drive for me, so I haven't done it as of yet. In the future, if I am working on a strike date, then I most likely will take part.
That's very, very interesting to know. And my next question to you is, have you noticed the strikes have affected the morale of the workplace? And do you find or have you experienced any hostility in these circumstances?
Yeah, so I think at the beginning when the strikes were just starting, there was a boost in morale due to the fact that a lot of the workers thought that we were going to have the chance to be heard and some of our problems were going to be addressed. I have noticed that as the strikes have been ongoing for a few months now, I think morale has decreased because people feel like they're not really being listened to. They feel like the strikes aren't having an impact, so they're getting a little bit frustrated. We have been met with quite a bit of hostility, not from members of the service, but from members of the public. Some people don't really understand the reason for it and don't think that we should be striking. But I will say overall, it has been positive and support. It's just been a small minority that have been a bit hostile.
And my next question, strikes of ambulance workers and nurses for you don't last too long. Do you feel that this is because of the nature of your job? And not everyone strikes for pay, but do you feel that this is due to treatment?
Yeah, so we have strict rules and guidelines that are set out relating to who can strike, how long.
And do you ever find yourself morally conflicted with striking, as there is a level of risk to someone's life?
And so that's a really interesting question. I think that on face value, it can be easy to feel, as you say, morally conflicted about striking due to the nature of the jobs. However, a couple of things, as I previously mentioned, there are very strict guidelines set out. So ambulances and staff will always be able to respond to the most life-threatening calls. There'll never be an occasion where, due to the strikes, there's not anybody to send to a category one call, we would call it. And I think personally that the main problem that the ambulance service is facing at the moment that makes it dangerous is one of the reasons that we're striking. So to me, almost in a way, it's like a little bit of bad to hopefully improve the service in the long term. Maybe having just slightly more delays in the strikes will mean that in the future the service is a lot better and able to respond more quickly, because at the moment it's not effective and safe as it currently stands.
Thank you. And my last question to you is, do you feel the government has implicated any scheme or funding to improve the current situation you are facing?
So currently we have not received an offer that we've been happy with. I know that in Scotland, the ambulance services are drawing up an agreement that they are happy with. I think they've got like quite a good pay rise, better working conditions. But the government in England, they haven't offered the same to the English ambulance services. So the strikes are going to continue until talks can take place that everybody can reach an agreement. I do see that happening in the future. I think that the demands, the things that are being requested by the ambulance services, are quite reasonable. It will just maybe take the government a while to actually come round and give them what they want.
Thank you very much. That was really interesting.
It was a really opening insight into how an ambulance worker feels about striking. What I took away from it is that the public against these strikes fear their safety, but as mentioned, she said they respond to the most critical situations and the service is already not as efficient as they would like it, hence the strikes. What did you guys take away from the interview?
I think from what was being discussed is that being part of a union is a privilege, as there is a small fee, but on the other hand, means your issues relating to pay and working conditions are heard and therefore can be acted upon within your union leaders. It is also clear from the interview that it's important for the government to act on their word in terms of creating policies for the benefit of the ambulance workers.
Yeah, I thought it was really good to hear that not everyone has to strike and that she was not forced to take part, because I think it should be everyone's individual choice whether to strike or not.
Yeah, I agree.
Another key point I think we should discuss is, I just feel that shouldn't key workers such as nurses be paid more? I just think nurses are at the forefront of society, helping people, saving lives. I think there's a real discussion to be had about why, say, sports people paid so much, why footballers paid so much and nurses aren't. I just wondered what you two thought.
No, yeah, I agree. Especially after coronavirus, like, we would go on the steps to clap for nurses every Thursday. They don't want our claps. They want more pay to represent their hours and work. And considering they were commended for the extra hours and sacrifice, they've not seen any reward, which is weird if you think that Boris Johnson might not actually be here if it wasn't for the intensive care unit that when he caught the virus, he was taken care of.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know about you, but I felt quite silly standing outside clapping. These nurses were out saving lives and all we could do was clap for them.
I reckon it like boosted morale, but other than that, they can't see everyone clapping that in the intensive care unit.
I agree. I agree with both of you. I think it's really, really important to address these specific issues and these specific things that need proper change and proper adaptation to improve these conditions and the pay of NHS workers.
Let's now move on to the strikes happening in the education sector. More specifically, the action of UCU, the University and College Union. Since as university students ourselves, we are more familiar with this action.
UCU have announced they are striking due to precarious employment conditions and anger towards the pay gap that exists between genders, ethnicities and those with disabilities.
Recently, UCU strikes were paused for 2 weeks as the union said it made significant progress. Dr. Joe Grady, UCU's General Secretary, has said, "To allow our ongoing negotiations to continue in a constructive environment, we have agreed to pause actions across our pay and working conditions and USS pensions disputes for the next 2 weeks and create a period of calm."
And what is being done about the missed learning?
University of Reading has set up a process called the Impact of Strike on Academic Performance to ensure students are not academically disadvantaged as a result of this action and there's travel claim expenses to be reimbursed for travel costs.
Yeah, I don't know about you two, but I'm paying 9k a year, so each lecture that I'm missing due to strikes is money out of my bank account, especially when teachers don't send us an email beforehand. Just saying.
And there's been a mention of a marking boycott if a settlement isn't reached, which now is looking like it hopefully might be. But if that were to go ahead, it would be difficult for us to get a degree without weeks of work being marked. And as for teachers of primary and secondary schools, the National Union of Teachers have declared they are striking due to shortage of staff, increased workload, lack of investment into schools and because of pay cuts. They want a 12% pay rise as they feel undervalued and a supermarket worker earns more. However, the government is only offering 5%.
The response of this is that parents are upset and do not want teachers to strike as it leaves them in a difficult position for childcare, but they are understanding towards staff for wanting better conditions.
Yes, it's difficult being affected by strikes, but having empathy towards the workers who feel they have no other option to be heard. I think another discussion point to discuss is, I don't know about you, but for uni, we had 2 months of striking dates that they were given to us. And I just think that's quite a lot. And when you're at uni, 2 months, quite a long time. So I just wondered what you thought of. How did that affect you?
Well, if you think about it, it's like a term, these 2 months of striking. And considering we only have, the winter term, spring term, summer term, that's a lot.
Yeah.
So, no, I agree. It is long, but then I guess to see effects, you have to be consistent and have to keep it ongoing. Otherwise, they probably would not be at the point where they are, like these discussions about settlement, if they hadn't been going for this long.
Obviously, I want to stress it wasn't 2 months straight of striking.
No,
it was dates across 2 months. But when you're in an academic year, 2 months is quite a long time.
Exactly. And if you think about when the assignments are all due at the end of the month, you need these 2 months of lectures to build up your essay. Yeah. So do you see the effects? And we got sent emails, obviously, discussing what's going to go on when they are striking, and they warned of picket lines, like staff being at the different entrances with banners, leaflets. And I remember seeing it a lot last year. I haven't seen it as much this year, but it gets me thinking, do you feel uncomfortable walking past the picket line of staff as students, like disagreeing with the way the university that you go to operate?
Yeah, like I think it can be quite daunting, like walking past staff members knowing that they are not turning up to work, also like with the intention to make a statement to the university, you know, on their pensions, and really taking a strong kind of stance on the situation. I think as a student can be nerve-wracking, or, you know, you may feel a bit uncomfortable, but at the end of the day, you do want to support them, but also you're going because you've paid, you know, to be taught in a subject, in a degree. So it's difficult sometimes.
Yeah, I totally agree. I also think sometimes it can be, you know, you don't want to feel peer pressured when you're walking past a big group of people like that, and they've all got their motives and their banners. Sometimes you feel like you have to speak to them and you have to go along with what they believe in. And also, I think sometimes it can be just quite disruptive. You've got all these people protesting, say you have to do work, or you're quite annoying, I would say.
Yeah, I get that, and I feel bad that I can't do anything to help, so I wouldn't really feel uncomfortable. I understand why they are doing it, and I just personally feel it's like more of a shame that I, as a student, can't help improving your situation, as it's up to higher positions, not us. Like, we have to pay the $9,000 a year, and we can't dictate where that goes to, so...
Yeah. Absolutely. Another topic I just thought I would raise with you two is another reason why they're striking is to do with working conditions. A lot of teachers say they're unhappy with them. And I just wanted to pay devil's advocate. I mean, I always thought the classrooms are quite clean, in my opinion. I always thought working conditions are quite good. I don't know. Do you think that's a fair reason for them to be striking?
I reckon it's not so much to do with like the actual environment. I think it's what goes on behind closed doors. So it's the, as they said, inequality. So this is to do with pay, more the working conditions, but it contributes to like the environment, as in behavior wise, like how women are treated in like women lectures, since there is a gender pay gap. Like that could affect different positions, you know, like more senior roles might treat the lower roles not as well. So it's like working conditions in that sense. They want to be equal.
Yeah, I think that's definitely very important to highlight, especially with everything going on and trying to equalize that gender pay gap, as you said, you know, to try and make it less of a big gap and try and close that. Yeah.
Especially in education, like you're teaching these things, but you're actually not practicing it. So
for sure.
Moving on to the next area of the public sector that's been affected, the railway.
The dispute was started over pay, job cuts and changes to term and conditions. Like the previous unions, the RMT say any pay offer should reflect the rising cost of living, which is currently above 10%. However, the rail industry is under pressure to save money due to the pandemic. Bosses say reforms need to be agreed to afford any pay increases and modernise the railway. Network Rail, which owns the track and other infrastructure, is planning to cut 1,900 jobs as part of changes, though it insists most of this could be achieved by people leaving voluntarily. The RMT disagrees with some of the changes and wants a guarantee of no compulsory job losses.
It was reported on the 7th of March that the RMT executive will suspend industrial action by Network Rail members due to reaching a settlement. This is similar to the UCU strikes. Do you think this is the right thing to do? pause strikes as soon as a settlement is in discussion, or for the unions to continue striking throughout the whole process to stop the on and off action so that the public aren't confused.
Yeah, I don't know about you, but I can see it both ways. It's important for rail workers that are heard, obviously. However, from the public's point of view, we would obviously like as little disruption as possible.
Yeah, I get that. I know that much of the general public tend to not keep up with the dates of industrial action. Because I know for one that I turn up to the train station some days expecting disruption, but they're not actually striking that day as it changes so frequently.
Do you feel that stopping the strikes halfway through slows down disruption, causing limitations on them from being like as effective?
I can see that, since strikes are supposed to bring about disruption, to bring about resolvement, but causing too much isn't great, as the public then have hostility towards that union, and ideally you want public support to get action from the government.
On the one hand, it's important to strive for better amenities to your job, but train and bus drivers do earn what some would say a comfortable amount of money per year. Why is there a high demand for a rise in pay from train drivers when they are clearly earning $62,000 per year? And for bus drivers, the average pay is like $32,000 per year.
Yeah, I understand that. I think from many workers' perspective, it is less to do with their pay and more so the security of their jobs. As RMT mentioned in their clause, they want a no compulsory job loss agreement. And I think that's fair, as 2,000 roles to get rid of is a lot and will affect many families' livelihoods, since they may get paid the 62 grand, but if they get made redundant, that money isn't much use to them.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. I think another point to raise is obviously travel causes a lot of disruption. Obviously, all strikes cause a lot of disruption, but especially travel strikes. And I just think there's a conversation to be had here about the moral side of that. You know, what do you two think about the moral side of disrupting commuters' lives?
Strikes have, for a long time, always disrupted people's lives. And on the morality of it, could cause someone emotional distress. You know, especially if there's some kind of emergency and there are no trains or transport to get them to their, like, destination. So it can place a lot of limitations and barriers to it. So it's frustrating.
Yeah, that is sad. And obviously not great. You can see at the station when a train is cancelled or delayed, workers in their suits like grumbling, like huffing puffing, and that's because it's most likely to cause a ripple effect, since they're probably then late for a meeting which affects somebody else's working day. But this is the point of a strike. If the government want to stop this lack of productivity, meet the workers' requests. It's like chess, a game of strategy, but yeah, it's not great morality wise that it affects the emotions of regular individuals. Since we are examining trade unions, let's explore and discuss the history of them and how this is relevant today.
The origin of trade unions can be traced back to the Industrial Revolution, as the conditions in new factories were often very harsh.
Even children were forced to work very long hours for low pay. It's clear that children would have been in environments that go against any child protection work environment law that we now know in our modern society.
During the 1970s, 21.9 million working days were lost to striking action, rising to 29.47 million in the winter of discontent in 1979. During this winter, the country was brought to a standstill by large-scale private and public sector strikes that caused food shortages, weeks of uncollected garbage, and in one city, the dead lied unburied.
The miners' strike was a big movement in 1972, and they were successful in gaining a higher pay, setting the path for modern-day striking.
Now, moving on to the current laws surrounding trade unions. The Trade Union Bill was introduced in 2015 and imposed that to strike, unions needed a minimum voting turnout of 50% of members, and public sector strikes would need the backing of at least 40% of those eligible to vote.
So if there are 100 teachers in a union, 50 of them will have to vote, and 40 out of 50 would have to be in favour of striking for a strike to commence.
These laws also require 14 days notice of strike action to allow companies to bring in agency workers. To me, I understand this law as it brings structure to the strikes, but kind of defeats the purpose of striking, as disruption would be limited and the government would not act. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak proposed new legislation in January that would enforce what he calls minimum service levels in key areas of the public sector, including education and healthcare, which would hamper strikes by sacking workers. Many are seeing this proposal similar to Thatcher's anti-strike laws in the late 1970s.
You know, I fully believe in the union's role in our society and the freedom for them to strike.
But I also believe that that should be balanced with the right of ordinary working people to go about their lives free from significant disruption. And that's why we're going to bring forward new laws in common with countries like France, Italy, Spain and others that ensure that we have minimum levels of safety in critical areas like fire, like ambulance, so that even when strikes are going on, you know that your health will be protected. I think that's entirely reasonable, and that's what our new laws will do. What we've said is we want to have a grown-up, honest conversation with all union leaders about what is responsible, what is reasonable, and what is affordable for our country when it comes to pay. We think that those conversations should happen. That's why we've invited everyone in to have those talks on Monday, and I'm hopeful that those talks can be constructive and we can find a way through this.
So, what do you guys think about this?
I think that Rishi Sunak is wanting to place limitations on strikes and to find some reason not to allow them to fight for these changes. And yet again, the government is trying to control the voice and actions of the people, where in society like we have today, this simply is not right.
Yeah, and that's why Labour is the party of working people and the Conservatives are not, because unions should not be sued for doing their role.
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously the clip is quite worrying. I think it just shows that the government want more control on the issue. I mean, you could argue it's somewhat dictatorial. I think the government clearly want more power and control back from these trade unions. And realistically, I think if you look between the lines, they want to be able to threaten by sacking them as almost a deterrent from being able to protest. So I think it obviously isn't great.
Yeah, definitely.
So let's discuss the significance of strikes. Does striking actually do anything?
I think they do, seen from previous union achievements. However, I do think the success is dependent on various factors, one being on the immediate effect on an employer. As, for example, if a single university lecturer does not show up to a lecture, not much happens to the entire business, whereas if a train driver does not show up, it has more of a domino effect as the train does not leave and it creates further disruption.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a reason for strikes not being a success is usually due to economic imbalance. Strikers don't want to risk not being able to feed their families or pay rent, so eventually go back and the strike is not sustained.
Yeah. What's interesting is that in 2022, more days were lost to strikes since the Thatcher era. Why do you think this is? Are we seeing more strikes because the pandemic has affected job security, cost of living crisis, or maybe a weakened Tory government? I personally think Britain is much angrier now. We're seeing workers fed up with the Conservative government after the last 3 years with how they have handled the pandemic, Brexit, their lack of security with having three PMs in the space of 3 months, that now in this cost of living crisis and uncertain economical future, striking is their only hope.
Yeah, absolutely. I think an interesting quote was from RMT General Secretary Mick Lynch, said in reference to the strikes, he said, "I think that the British public are fed up of being ripped off by the government and by corporate Britain, which have seen companies like BP and British Gas making massive profits while people are struggling to make a living."
You can also, you know, kind of say that another reason for the rise in strikes could be down to an increase in social media's attention to push, you know, these stories and make them viral in grabbing young people's attentions. As in theory, you know, Noam Chomsky was known for discussing the idea of the machine of social media influencing people's opinion.
I agree. And unions do try and target younger demographics, which is easier via social media, where they are the main consumers. And I firmly believe young people do need to unite to be the pinnacle of change and protect workers' rights and challenge employers, as navigating employment as a young person, it's very easy to be taken advantage of.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think on top of this, technology and social media make planning and organising strikes much easier, which I think suggests why there's a significant rise in more strikes happening.
Definitely.
Thanks for watching this B Radio political podcast. Goodbye from us in the studio, and I hope to see you next week.